John chapter 6 and a parallel passage in Mark chapter 6. We're going to be talking about one of the miracles of Jesus in the Gospel of John that once again point to his deity, in this case, his power over the forces of nature in a storm as he walks on the water. And it will begin in verse 16 of John chapter 6. There was a man who was preparing for a very important speaking engagement, and he hadn't had a lot of experience in speaking engagements. So he was struggling. He was getting nervous, and he's complaining to his wife that, you know, whenever I think about this speech I have to give, my palms on my hands, they just start getting so sweaty. And then an hour or so later, he turned to his wife and he said, you know, honey, whenever I think about doing this speech, my mouth gets dry. And she says, well, you know what I think might help? If your palms get sweaty and your mouth gets dry, why not try licking your palms? Well, we find the disciples today in a situation where they are filled with fear. And I would suppose perhaps their palms were sweaty and their mouth was dry, because we come to a passage today where they find themselves in the midst of a storm and they are absolutely full of fear. Now, there's three gospel writers that have this account. Matthew covers this account, Mark covers this account, John covers this account. And they all give different additional details. So today we want to look at John's account, and we want to kind of refer to Mark's account as well for additional information to fill in some spaces. But looking in John chapter 6, beginning in verse 16, it says this: when evening came, his disciples went down to the lake, where they got into a boat, and they set off across the lake for Capernaum. By now it was dark, and Jesus had not yet joined them. A strong wind was blowing, and the waters grew rough. When they had rowed 3 or 3.5 miles, they saw Jesus approaching the boat, walking on the water, and they were terrified. But he said to them, "It is I, don't be afraid." Then they were willing to take him into the boat, and immediately the boat reached the shore where they were heading. Turn, if you would, to the Gospel of Mark now, Mark chapter 6. Verse 45. Immediately Jesus made his disciples get into the boat and go on ahead of him to Bethsaida. While he dismissed the crowd, after leaving them, he went up on a mountainside to pray. When evening came, the boat was in the middle of the lake, and he was all alone on land. He saw the disciples straining at the oars because the wind was against them. About the fourth watch of the night, he went out to them, walking on the lake. He was about to pass by them when they saw him walking on the lake. They thought he was a ghost. They cried out because they all saw him and were terrified. Immediately he spoke to them and said, "Take courage. It is I. Don't be afraid." Then he climbed into the boat with them, and the wind died down. They were completely amazed, for they had not understood about the loaves. Their hearts were hardened. When they had crossed over, they landed at Gennesaret and anchored there. The sea in that particular culture, at that particular time, maybe much as today, the sea was viewed as a very ominous kind of sinister, dangerous threat, a dangerous kind of place. And in this particular case, the Sea of Galilee, even though it wasn't like the Mediterranean or the Atlantic or the Pacific, it was a relatively small lake by comparison.
about 13 miles from north to south, about 7 miles across, a deep freshwater lake. But it was still considered the Sea of Galilee. And it was located in kind of like a low bowl-type gap in the terrain. And picture this, on either side of the lake, you have on one side, the east side, the Golan Heights. And they go up to about 2,000 miles. On the opposite side, you have the hill country of Galilee, apparently reaching another elevation of about 2,000 higher than the shore of the Sea of Galilee. Those elevations, positioned as they are with the hills, they created a funnel-type effect often. So you get from the Mediterranean Sea, a real ocean, 30 miles away, sometimes you get these major weather fronts come through. They'd pass across the Valley of Jezreel, and those winds would be funneled through these high passes in these hills. And they'd be funneled, they'd be channeled, directly targeting the Sea of Galilee. And these storms would come up suddenly. They'd come up unexpectedly. They didn't have Doppler radar to warn them. And when they hit that sea, they stirred up the water, sometimes to elevations of like 20 feet waves. So they're caught in one of these storms that came upon the Sea of Galilee. They're in the storm. That's the point. They are in a storm. It was dark. They were out in the lake at a distance of about 3 miles. They were in the middle of the Sea of Galilee in a storm. They were wet. They were exhausted. They'd been rowing against the wind. They'd been rowing against the waves. And they weren't getting anywhere. All the efforts they were putting forth in the midst of the storm just seemed absolutely futile. And for these experienced fishermen, this was perhaps in their minds the mother of all storms. And if that description sounds bad, let me assure you that it was worse than the description that I've given. But then add this to the situation. When the storm perhaps is at its very worst, and when they are probably at their very worst as far as fatigue and exhaustion, suddenly they notice a figure. It's dark. They notice a figure. The figure is coming across the water. It's the figure of someone. I kind of think about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fire. When they came out of the fire, they were not singed. They were not scorched. They didn't even smell like smoke. It had no effect on them. They see this figure coming across the sea in the middle of a storm with maybe, 20-foot waves. And the wind and the waves are having no effect upon this individual. They rub their eyes. They look again. They think, is this a phantom? Is this a ghost? Is this a spirit? Is this a demon? Whatever it was, in their minds, this was not a good thing. This was a bad omen. They took it as that, and they, at that moment, felt as though they were doomed. So they storm. And what we want to do as we look at this passage is to realize that there are going to be storms in our own lives. And they may not be literal storms like this, where we're out on the sea, but we all experience storms within our lives. And that's what I want you to think about this morning, is to think about the storms in your life. Storms come into our lives in the form of illness, in the form of opposition, in the form of unemployment, in the form of pressures in the workplace. Storms come into our lives in the form of bereavement, suffering over the loss of someone who was dear to us and close to us. Sufferings come to our lives in relationship difficulties. We may experience persecution and other kinds of opposition. You know, there may come times in our lives when we come under a full frontal assault from the enemy, the devil himself. And they come upon us. So often they come without any Doppler warning. They come upon us suddenly. They come upon us unexpectedly, just like the storm at the Sea of Galilee. And the Bible's absolutely right. In the book of Job, it says, man is born to trouble as surely as sparks fly upward. And it's absolutely true. We are born to trouble as sure as sparks fly upward. I think the longer I live and the older I get, the more I'm aware of that reality. And the more I cry out, even so, Lord Jesus, come. Come quickly. One author said, we are either in trouble, getting out of trouble, or thinking about something that's going to get us into trouble. And that's about the way it is. So again, point being, the disciples are in the storm. But as we look at their experience, there's a few takeaways I want you to take for yourself as you experience your own storms. The disciples were in the storm. But even though they are in the storm, we find in this passage, in these two passages, that even though they are in the storm, they are also, while in the storm, they are in the will of Jesus Christ. While in the storm, they are in the will of God. And so often what we find when we're facing troubles is we start to ask, well, God, what did I do wrong? What did I do to bring this upon myself? And we question whether we are at fault. But Mark chapter 6 gives us a component to this story that I think is very important. In Mark 6, verse 46, it says, immediately Jesus made his disciples get into the boat and go ahead of him to Bethsaida while he dismissed the crowd. Literally, that word could be translated, he compelled them to go. So their situation, it wasn't happenstance. It wasn't a case of really, really bad luck. It was to no fault of their own. It wasn't an issue of poor planning on their part. It wasn't an issue of poor timing on their part. It hadn't been because they were stupid, because they were careless, because they were negligent, or because they had been in any way whatsoever disobedient. In fact, they were in a storm because they had been obedient to Jesus Christ. They were obedient to the command of Christ. And even though they had been obedient to the command of Christ, and at this moment were in the perfect will of Christ, yet at that moment, because of the storm, they were unable to make any headway against the storm so as to fulfill the command of Jesus Christ and go to the other side of the lake. So you hear what I'm saying? I'm saying the disciples were not in the storm because they were out of God's will. Just the opposite is true. They were in the storm because they were in God's will. Well, again, the application is that storms, hardship, peril, chaos, deep suffering will invade our lives. It's a given. As sure as sparks fly upward, these storms are going to invade our lives. But understand this. They're not necessarily any indication whatsoever that you somehow have stepped out of God's will. In fact, the reality may be just the opposite. Of course, one example of that reality is the Bible that those who would live godly lives are going to suffer persecution. Right there you have an example. You seek to live a godly life. You place yourself in the will of God, and it invites opposition. It invites persecution. All I'm trying to say is, in the midst of the storms in your life, you don't necessarily need to beat yourself up as though you yourself have done something wrong to deserve it. Maybe you did, all right? I'm just saying that here's an example where it's just the opposite. Thomas Brooks, 17th century Puritan. The Puritans had a lot of quotes. He said this. He said, "God, who is infinite in wisdom and matchless in his goodness, has ordered our troubles." Yes, he says, troubles may come trooping in upon us from every side. He says, as our mercies, so our crosses, so our troubles seldom come singly or alone. And Jesus' disciples are a perfect illustration of what he's saying. I mean, literally, troubles were coming down upon them, trooping upon them, one upon the heels of the other. One wave crashing down upon the deck, flooding it out. Another wave upon the heels of that wave, coming down, crashing upon them. Wave upon the heel of wave, trooping down. And so that's the way so often, isn't it? That troubles come into our lives. It's just one wave after the next wave after the next wave, and we're just reeling from it, barely able to get our composure, and sometimes suffering just that sense of exhaustion and fatigue, as though try as we're just getting nowhere in the midst of this struggle. But then again, we need to remember the disciples in the midst of this storm. These troubles did not come upon them by chance. These troubles came upon them under the sovereignty of God. And as I thought about it, that old hymn came to my mind. Whatever God ordaineth is right. So if you find yourself in the midst of a storm, keep that in mind, that God orders sometimes in our lives. He allows them grow into the character of Christ and gain glory for him through the trials. The disciples are in the midst of the storm. You understand? And though they are in the midst of the storm, they are in the will of God. Another point to be made is the disciples, they are in the storm. But they are in the storm, but even though they are in the storm, they are also in the school of Jesus Christ. While in the storm, they are also in the school of Jesus Christ. We can go back a week or two ago to a previous message where we talked about the feeding of the 5,000. And we saw in the feeding of the 5,000 that once again,
God is testing his disciples. And there's a group of 20,000 people or more, I would imagine. And Jesus notes that they're hungry. He turns to his disciples and he says, "You feed them." He was testing them. And the passage says that he was testing them. But it also says that all along, Jesus knew exactly what he was doing. In other words, in that case, as in this case, Jesus will allow impossible situations into our lives, as with the feeding of the 5,000. He'll allow troubles into our lives, as with the disciples on the Sea of Galilee. But those impossibilities that God allows, those troubles that God allows in our lives, those are simply God's curriculum. They're God's curriculum to teach us and to mature us in our faith. James 1, 2-4 says, "Consider it pure joy, my brothers and sisters, whenever you face trials of many kinds, because you know the testing of your faith produces perseverance, and let perseverance finish its work, so that you may be complete and mature, not lacking anything." God's curriculum. Isaiah 48:10. God speaks to us and says, "See, I have refined you, though not as silver, I have tested you." Where? He says, "I have tested you in the furnace of affliction." You ever find yourself in the furnace of affliction? It's God's curriculum. I like to say back in my day, because I've gotten to the age in life where I can say that. And sometimes I'll say to my boys or my sons, who aren't boys anymore, "Back in my day." And when I say "back in my day," usually I'm thinking probably in the 70s. Well, back in my day, there was a Christian soloist, composer, Andre Crouch, and he had a song with these lyrics: "I've had many tears and sorrows. I've had questions for tomorrow. There's been times I didn't know right from wrong. But in every situation, God gave me blessed consolation that my trials come to only make me strong. I thank God for the mountains, and I thank him for the valleys. I thank him for the storms he brought me through. For if I never had a problem, I wouldn't know God could solve them. I'd never know what faith in God can do." And I've said this before. The one thing that God values most is faith. He places a higher value on your faith in him than in any other commodity. And so he allows experiences in our lives. He ordains experiences in our lives, troubles, not to defeat us, but troubles to surface that faith that is within us and to bring it out of us into the open, so that God can receive glory through the faith of his children, who in times of trouble, just like Job, put their trust in him. Job said, "Though you slay me, God, though you slay me, I'll put my hope in you. Though you slay me, I'll trust in you." Who got the glory for that?
God got the glory for that. We still talk about it today. It's still bringing glory to God, even to this day. And when you encounter troubles and you respond to God's testing in that way, be assured that the faith you display is a faith that will continue to proclaim God's glory throughout the ages of eternity. The poet said this. He said, "I walked a mile with pleasure, and she chatted all the way, but left me none the wiser for all she had to say. I walked a mile with sorrow, and not a word she said, but oh, the things I learned from sorrow when sorrow walked with me." So our troubles, look upon them as God's curriculum for our lives. They were in God's school. Another point. Again, the disciples are in the storm. But though they are in the storm, we find as we merge these two accounts together that even though they are in the storm, they are in the sight of Jesus Christ. Even though they are in the storm, they are in the view of Jesus. Again, you can see that in Mark chapter 6, verses 47 to 48. Now, I was reading this week, I got curious as far as, you know, well, just exactly, you know, what is the range of vision as far as our distance for the human eye? Because these guys were like three, pushing maybe 4 miles out into the lake. And it says Jesus saw them on the lake. Well, what I read said that the earth's surface curves out of sight at a distance of about 3.1 miles. So, on level ground, our viewing distance can't go beyond that 3.1 miles because of the curvature of the earth. But if you're on a mountaintop, well, it all changes. Your vantage point is higher. And so, as you know, from a mountaintop, sometimes you can see for miles. You know, given the brightness of a light, you might see a light hundreds of miles away in the distance from a mountaintop on a clear night. Well, in this particular case, Jesus is on a mountaintop. And I don't know whether at this point his sight was using his natural sight or his supernatural sight, because obviously it was dark. Obviously it must have been stormy out at that sea and cloudy. The moonlight certainly would have been covered. But it doesn't really matter. Whether supernatural seeing or natural seeing, Jesus saw them. They were in his sight. He saw the clouds begin to roll in. He saw the waves of the sea as they began to rise and fall. We're told he even saw the disciples as they were straining at the oars. You know, I imagine it was so dark at that particular time, and the rain perhaps was pelting them so quickly that the disciples probably in the midst of that storm could hardly see each other. Yet Jesus saw them. Jesus saw them from a distance. Jesus saw it all. Do you see the application to our own lives? Far from being abandoned in the midst of the storm of life, Jesus, high from the vantage point of heaven,
Just as surely as he saw the disciples straining at the oars in the midst of the storm, Jesus sees you straining at the oars to the point of exhaustion in the midst of your own storms. He sees it all. Psalm 139:2 says, "You know when I sit down and when I rise up. You perceive my thoughts from afar. You discern my going out and my lying down, and you are familiar with all my ways." And then verse 11 goes on and says, "If I say, surely the darkness shall cover me, and the light about me be night, even the darkness is not dark to you." That was certainly true here, wasn't it? The darkness was not dark to Jesus Christ. The night is as bright as the day, for darkness is as light with you. So there's comfort in this for us. There's comfort just in knowing that we are always within his view. Wherever you may be, whatever your circumstances may be, whether you are alone or whether you are in the company of others, whether you are in sickness or you are in health, by land or by sea, Jesus Christ has his eye on you. You are never beyond his range of sight. I don't know, sometimes when I'm doing these messages, lyrics come to my mind from different songs. And the jingle that comes to my mind on this occasion is the Christmas song that goes like this. He knows when you've been sleeping. He knows when you're awake. He knows when you've been bad or good. So be good, for goodness sake. Well, that song pretty much, you know, attributes omniscience to Santa Claus. But let's get real here for a moment and move beyond Santa Claus. And I'd like to change the lyrics and keep the jingle itself. Let's change it to reflect the reality. He, Jesus, sees when you're in sorrow. He sees when you're in pain. He sees when you've been ill or well. So, take courage. Take courage, for goodness sake. So again, the disciples are in the storm. But even though they're in the storm, we also find that they are in the prayers of Jesus Christ. Don't you like that? Even though they are in the storm, they're in the prayers of Jesus Christ. Now here we're getting into something that's the mystery of the Trinity. There's one God. There's God the Father. There's God the Son. There's God the Holy Spirit. And on this occasion, we find God the Son in his humanity high atop a mountain. And what do we find him doing, even as they are in the storm? He's praying. And I can't imagine that Jesus would have been there praying, knowing his disciples were in the storm at that moment, and not have added them to his prayer request list. I think we can confidently draw the conclusion that Jesus, while they were in the storm, he was praying for them. Mark 6:46 tells us he was praying. So we need to realize again, by way of application, that in the middle of your storm, Jesus has you on his prayer list. Hebrews 2:25 says it. It tells us, therefore he, Jesus, is able to save. How far can he save? He's able to save completely those who come to God through him,
Because he always lives to do what? To intercede for them. Jesus Christ, seated at the right hand of God the Father Almighty, lives to intercede for you. He's communing with the Father on high, even as he looks down upon your daily walk. And as an example of Jesus interceding for us and praying for us, you don't have to go any further than Jesus' high priestly prayer in John chapter 17 to see how Jesus prays for us. Isn't that amazing? You're always within his sight. Not a moment of any given day when you are outside the range of his vision. And as you remain in the range of his vision, Jesus Christ is interceding, praying for you, just as he prayed for those disciples. So, the disciples are in the storm. But although they are in the storm, we also find in this passage that though they are in the storm, they are in the care. They are in the care of Jesus Christ. I guess the most encouraging thing in this passage is that Jesus comes. In the midst of their storm, he comes. He comes to them. He comes to us in our storms. He may not come to us as tangibly as we might like. He might not come to us as soon as we might wish him to. Jesus comes. Literally, it said, when they saw him, not knowing who or what it was, they screamed. They were terrified. Both accounts say that. But Jesus' first words to them upon his appearance is, be of good cheer. Take courage. Don't be afraid. I think that command, don't be afraid, is the most repeated command you'll find in Scripture. God knew we needed that word of encouragement. And Jesus comes to them. Take courage. Be of good cheer. Don't be afraid. There's a word of reminder. It is I. He came with a word of reassurance. Be not afraid. Again, when Jesus walked on that water, he walked with the same confidence with which you might walk down the sidewalk. I mean, he walked with full confidence as at any other time in his life. He walked through that storm across that water with the same steadiness and the same balance in his gait that he'd always had. He walked with the same dignity in his bearing. The wind and the waves, they were having no visible effect upon him as he walked. And they saw then and there that for Jesus Christ, the thing that they feared the most, the sea, for Jesus Christ was only a path to bring him to them. And so the next time you're going through troubles, wouldn't it be nice if you could view those troubles as a path by which Jesus Christ, in the midst of those troubles, is able to gain our attention and able to come to us. Jesus displays his power over the sea, over the waves, by walking on them. In Job 9:8, it says that God is the one who stretches out the heavens and he tramples the waves of the sea. I got another song coming to mind. These boots were made for walking. And one of these days, these boots are going to walk all over you. Well, Jesus' boots were made for walking. And Jesus tramples beneath his boots the waves of the sea. And he tramples beneath his boots any troubles that might come into your life. Now we're winding things down, so the second miracle, we see a second miracle really here that it's easy to let slip by. But it says that as soon as they took him into the boat, immediately what happened? Immediately they found themselves on the other side, on the shore. Jesus here is suspending the laws of space and time in order to transport them to his intended destination. And Jesus Christ can do the same thing for us. He can suspend the laws of time and space to ensure that we will arrive at his intended destination. And I like to look at that as heaven, the place that he has prepared for us. Just as Jesus has power over the laws of time and space, he has power over any troubles or any circumstances that come into your life. No pain is too painful. No distance is too far. No trouble is too troublesome. No darkness is too dark. No chaos is too chaotic. No fear is too frightening for Jesus Christ. But the reality is, in the midst of our troubles, we have to acknowledge him, don't we? We have to exercise faith. And we have to consciously let him in. We have to consciously receive him into our boat. And when Jesus comes in, somehow, his blessed assurance overwhelms us. When sorrows like sea billows roll, whatever my lot, thou hast taught me to say, it is well with my soul. Now, John's account of the storm, doesn't include a lot of the details the other accounts have. John's account of the storm doesn't include Peter walking on the water and almost drowning. John's account narrows it down to the lowest common denominator, to the bare minimal amount of information. I think John leaves out a lot of material, a lot of detail, because his intent is to focus the narrative upon one person. He's focusing it upon Jesus Christ, who helps you in the storm. And so again, they let him in the boat, and immediately they arrived where they were going, and the storm was over. Point again being, when the storms of life come, let him in, let him join you, and that takes faith. Let me end with a story. There's a story of a guy, a pioneer missionary named John G. Patton. And he was one of these missionaries who served before we had groups like Wycliffe Bible Translators. He went in among a native group of people, and his intent was, first of all, to learn their language. And having learned their language, his intent was to put their language in written form. And having put their language in written form, his intent was to translate the Bible into that language, having taught them to read their own language. And in the course of Bible translation, he realized a major barrier. He could find no word in their language for faith. How do you translate the Bible into their language if there's no word in their language for faith? Well, on one occasion, a hunting party of the men had returned. And they had returned with several deer. And they were carrying these huge bodies of the deer they had shot on poles, you know, on their shoulders. They were carrying them with poles. And when they arrived in their village, having carried these heavy animals on their shoulders with poles, they were tired. They were weary. They were fatigued. They were weighted down from the journey. He noticed one of the natives reached the porch and dropped his load and said in his language, "It's good to stretch out here and rest." And immediately he knew that was his phrase. That was his word for faith. It's good to stretch out here and rest. And that's what this passage would teach us to do when we face the storms in life, when the burdens are so heavy and the struggle is so hard. The invitation of this passage would be, stretch out here and rest. Stretch yourself out on Jesus and rest in Him. If you stretch out and rest in Jesus, we have the promise of Isaiah chapter 43, verse 2, which says, "When you pass through the waters, I will be with you. And through the rivers, they shall not overflow you." Let's pray. Our Father, again, we thank you.